If Spotty were picked up with part of the stuff on him, the case would be clinched. It was also possible that Spotty, in a bad jam with nothing to lose, might spill. A far safer way would be for him to hold on to the stuff. Then Spotty could come for his share when and if he succeeded in losing the telltale prints. It was obviously the only safe and reasonable course. The trouble was that Spotty, when it was suggested to him, did not see it that way. They drove a few more miles, each occupied with his own thoughts. In a quiet lane, they stopped once more. Again, Spotty got out of the car and walked a few yards away from it. The moon was lower, but it still gave enough light to show the footprints following him. He came back looking more worried than frightened. Smudger decided to cut possible loss and go back to his former plan.
"Look here," he suggested. "What say we share out our takings now, and you drop me off a bit up the road?"
Spotty looked doubtful, but Smudger pressed.
"If you can shake that trail off, well and good. If you can't, well, there's no sense in us both getting pinched, is there? Anyway, it was you who croaked him, and one has a better chance of getting away than two."
Spotty was still not keen, but he had no alternative to offer. Smudger pulled the attaché case out of the back and opened it between them. Spotty began to separate the bundles of notes into two piles. It had been a good haul. As Smudger watched, he felt a great sadness that half of it was going to benefit nobody when Spotty was picked up. Sheer waste, it seemed to him. Spotty, with his head bent over his work, did not notice Smudger draw the piece of lead pipe out of his pocket. Smudger brought it down on the back of his head with such force and neatness that it is doubtful whether Spotty ever knew anything about it. Smudger stopped the car at the next bridge and pushed Spotty's body over the low wall. He watched as the ripples widened out across the canal below. Then he drove on. It was 3 days later that Smudger got home. He arrived in the kitchen, soaked to the skin and clutching his attaché case. He was looking worn, white, and ready to drop. He dragged a chair away from the table and slumped into it.
"Bill,"
his wife whispered.
"What is it? Are they after you?"
"No, Liz. At least, it ain't the cops, but something is."
He pointed to a mark close inside the door. At first she thought it was his own wet footprint.
"Get a cloth, Liz. Clean up the front step and passage before anyone sees it," he said.
She hesitated, puzzled.
"For God's sake, do it quick, Liz," he urged her.
Still half bewildered, she went through the dark passage and opened the door. The rain was pelting down, seeming to bounce up from the road as it hit. The gutters were running like torrents. Everything streamed with wetness, save the doorstep, protected by a small jutting porch. And on the step was the blood-red print of a naked foot. In a kind of trance, she went down on her knees and swabbed it clean with the wet cloth. Closing the door, she switched on the lights and saw the prints leading towards the kitchen. When she had cleaned them up, she went back to her husband.
"You been hit, Bill?"
He looked at her, elbows on the table, his head supported between his hands.
"Nah," he said. "It ain't me what's making them marks, Liz. It's what's following me."
"Following you? You mean they've been following you all the way back from the job?"
she asked incredulously.
"And how'd you get back?"
Smudger explained. His immediate anxiety after pitching Spotty into the canal had been to rid himself of the car. It had been a pinch for the job, and the number and description would have been circulated. He had parked it in a quiet spot and got out to walk, maybe pick up a lift. When he had gone a few yards, he looked back and had seen the line of prints behind him. They had frightened him a good deal more than he now admitted. Until that moment, he had assumed that since they had been following Spotty, they would have followed him into the canal. Now, it seemed, they had transferred their attentions to himself. He tried a few more steps. They followed. With a great effort, he got a grip on himself and refrained from running. He perceived that unless he wanted to leave a clear trail, he must go back to the car. He did. Farther on, he tried again, and with a sinking, hopeless feeling, observed the same result. Back in the car, he lit a cigarette and considered plans with as much calmness as he could collect. The thing to do was to find something that would not show tracks or would not hold them. A flash of inspiration came to him, and he headed the car towards the river. The sky was barely grey yet. He fancied that he'd managed to get the car down to the towpath without being seen. At any rate, no one had hailed him as he cut through the long grass to the water's edge. From there he had made his way downstream, plodding along a few inches of water until he found a rowboat. It was a venerable and decrepit affair, but it served his purpose. From then on his journey had been unexciting, but also uncomfortable. During the day he'd become extremely hungry, but he did not dare to leave the boat until after dark, and then he moved only by the darker streets where the marks might not be seen. Both that day and the next two he had spent hoping for rain. This morning, in a drenching downpour that looked like it might continue for hours, he had sunk the boat and made his way home, trusting that the trail would be washed away. As far as he knew, it had been. Liz was less impressed than she ought to have been.
"I reckon it must be something on your boots," she said practically. "Why didn't you buy some new ones?"
He looked at her with a dull resentment.
"It ain't nothing on me boots," he said. "Didn't I tell you it was following me? You seen the marks? How could they come off my boots? Use your head."
"But it don't make sense. Not the way you say it. What's following you?"
"How do I know?" he said bitterly. "All I know is it makes them marks. And they're getting closer, too."
"How do you mean, closer?"
"Just what I say. The first day, it was about 5 feet behind me. Now they're between 3 and 4.
It was not the kind of thing that Liz could take in too easily.
"It don't make sense,"
she repeated. It made no sense during the days that followed, but she ceased to doubt. Smudger stayed in the house. Whatever was following stayed with him. The marks of it were everywhere. On the stairs, upstairs, downstairs. Half Liz's time was spent in cleaning them up, lest someone should come in and see them. They got on her nerves, but not as badly as they got on Smudger's. Even Liz could not deny that the feet were stepping a little more closely behind him, a little more closely each day.
"What happens when they catch up?"
Smudger demanded fearfully.
"Tell me what? What can I do? What the hell can I do?"
But Liz had no suggestions, nor was there anyone else they dared ask about it. Smudger began to dream nights. He'd whimper, and she'd wake him up, asking what was the matter. The first time he could not remember, but the dream was repeated, growing a little clearer with each reoccurrence. A black shape appeared to hang over him as he lay. It was vaguely manlike in form, but it hovered in the air as if suspended. Gradually, it sank lower and lower, until it rested upon him, but weightlessly, like a pattern of fog. It seemed to flow up towards his head, and he was in panic, lest it should cover his face and smother him. But at his throat it stopped. There was a prickling at the side of his neck. He felt strangely weak, as though tiredness suddenly invaded him. At the same time, the shadow appeared to grow denser. He could feel, too, that there began to be some weight in it as it lay upon him. Then, mercifully, Liz would wake him. So real was the sensation that he inspected his neck carefully in the mirror when he shaved, but there was no mark there. Gradually, the glistening red prints closed in behind him, a foot behind his heels, 6 inches, 3 inches. Then came a morning when he awoke tired and listless. He had to force himself to get up, and when he looked in the mirror, there was a mark on his throat. He called Liz in a panic, but it was only a very small mark, and she made nothing of it. But the next morning his lassitude was greater. It needed all his willpower to drag himself up. The pallor of his face shocked Liz, and himself too, when he saw it in the shaving mirror. The red mark on his neck stood out more vividly. The next day, he did not get up. 2 days later, Liz became frightened enough to call in the doctor. It was a confession of desperation. Neither of them cared for the doctor, who knew or guessed uncomfortably much about the occupation of his patients. One called a doctor for remedies, not for homilies on one's way of life. He came, he hummed, he hawed, he prescribed a tonic, and had a talk with Liz.
"He's seriously anemic,"
he said.
"But there's more to it than that. Something on his mind."
He looked at her.
"Have you any idea what it is?"
Liz's denial was unconvincing. He did not even pretend to believe it.
"I'm no magician,"
he said.
"If you don't help me, I can't help him. Some kinds of worry can go on pressing and nagging like an abscess."
Liz continued to deny. For a moment, she had been tempted to tell about the footprints, but caution warned her that once she began, she would likely be trapped into saying more than was healthy.
"Think it over,"
the doctor advised,
"and let me know tomorrow how he is."
The next morning, there was no doubt that Smudger was doing very badly. The tonic had done him no good at all. He lay in bed with his eyes, when they were open, looking unnaturally large in a drawn white face. He was so weak that she had to feed him with a spoon. He was frightened, too, that he was going to die. So was Liz. The alarm in her voice when she telephoned the doctor was unmistakably genuine.
"All right, I'll be around within an hour,"
he told her.
"Have you found out what's in his mind yet?"
he added.
No,
Liz told him. When he came, he told her to stay downstairs while he went up to see the patient. It seemed to her that an intolerably long time passed before she heard his feet on the stairs, and she went out to meet him in the hall. She looked up into his face with mute anxiety. His expression was serious and puzzled, so that she was afraid to hear him speak. But at last she asked,
Is he going to die, Doctor?
He's very weak. Very weak indeed, the doctor said.
After a pause, he added,
Why didn't you tell me about those footprints you thought were following him?
She looked up at him in alarm.
It's all right. He told me all about it now. I knew there was something on his mind.
It's not very surprising, either.
Liz stared at him.
Not in the circumstances, no, the doctor said. A mind oppressed by a sense of sin can play a lot of nasty tricks. Nowadays they talk of guilt complexes and inhibitions. Names change. When I was a boy, the same sort of thing was known as a bad conscience. When one has the main facts, these things become obvious to anyone of experience. Your husband was engaged in, well, to put it bluntly, burgling the house of a man whose interests were mystic and occult. Something that happened there gave him a shock and unbalanced his judgment. As a result, he has difficulty in distinguishing between the real things he sees and the imaginary ones his uneasy conscience shows him. It is very complicated. He feels like he's being dogged. Somewhere in his subconscious lies the lines from the Ancient Mariner. Because he knows a frightful fiend doth close behind him tread. And the two come together. And in addition to that, it appears to have developed a primitive, vampiric type of phobia. Now, once we're able to help him dispel this obsession, he
broke off suddenly, aware of the look on his listener's face.
"What is it?"
he asked.
"But, Doctor,"
Liz said,
"those footprints. I..."
She was cut short abruptly by the sound from above that was half groan and half scream. The doctor was up the stairs before she could move. When she followed him, it was with a heavy certainty in her heart. She stood in the doorway, watching as he bent over the bed. In a moment he turned, grave-eyed, and gave her a slight shake of his head. He put his hand on her shoulder, then went quietly past her, out of the room. For some seconds Liz stood without moving. Then her eyes dropped from the bed to the floor. She trembled. Laughter, a high-pitched, frightening laughter, shook her as she looked at the red, naked footprints, which led away from the bedside, across the floor, and down the stairs. After the doctor.